Senate will come to order. Chief Clerk, call the roll.
Roll call for Thursday, February 3rd. Barnard.
Here.
Bebout.
Here.
Burns.
Here.
Case.
Here.
Christensen.
Here.
Coe.
Here.
Cooper.
Here.
Dockstader.
Here.
Driscoll.
Here.
Emmerich. Sturt, Hicks, Hines, Jennings, Johnson, Landon, Martin, Meyer, Nicholas, Nutting, Perkins, Peterson, Ross, Rothfuss, Schiffer, Scott, Von Slatern, President Anderson.
Here.
30 present.
Prayer by Reverend Gilbert.
Please join me in prayer. God of eternal providence and unfolding purpose, there are times and events in our lives when doors open unexpectedly and opportunities present themselves surprisingly, that we believe there is a meaningful mystery at work within and among us. We may have different names and different beliefs for and about that mystery, but the important matter is how it forms and shapes our belief and our behavior. Maybe we call it candid circumstances, and maybe we call it purposeful providence, but whatever name we choose to use, for those of us who believe that the mystery of your gracious guidance is within our personal interest, placing our feet on pleasant paths, offering a second and even a third chance after failing the first, for allowing us to be and to do far more than we ever thought or dreamed, we are grateful. In that gratitude, now let the words of our mouths, the meditations of our hearts, and the deeds of our hands be pleasing and acceptable in your sight, everlasting God, and beneficial for others. And all who were able in this chamber said, Amen.
Amen. Please join me in pledge. I pledge
allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Will the reading clerk please read the Journal Committee report?
Mr. President, your Journal Committee reports that the Journal of February the 2nd, 2011, has been read and recommends that it be approved. Senator Nutting, Chairman.
Are there any objections? There being none, that report is adopted. Our doctor for the day is Dr. Tom Radosevich from Casper. Doctor, thank you very much for your service today. We have no nurse today. On this day in Wyoming history, in 1926, Laramie radio station KFBU broadcast from the Episcopal Cathedral basement. On this day in U.S. history, in 1690, the first paper money in America was issued in the colony of Massachusetts. I understand that printing press is still operating. First reading, House bills on first, I'm sorry. Yes, you may, Dr. or Senator Bernard.
Members of the Senate, I'd like to introduce Van Johnson. He's a citizen from Evanston, Wyoming. He's vice president of our regional hospital there. He was on the board that helped build the prison, and he's a past president of Evanston Wells Fargo, and in 2004, he was our citizen of the year. I'd like you to say hi to Van Johnson.
Yeah. Thank you, and welcome to the Senate. Now we're ready for House bills on first reading. House Bill 167, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 167, Castle Doctrine Modifications and Act Relating to Crimes and Offenses, sponsored by Representative Qualberg. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 58, noes 1, absent 1.
House Bill 167 has been referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. House Bill 145, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 145, Vehicle Registration Timing, an Act Relating to Motor Vehicle Registration, sponsored by Representative Ken Escobel. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 57, noes 2, absent 1.
House Bill 145 has been assigned to Committee Number 3, Revenue. House Bill 146, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 146, Vehicle Sales and Use Tax, an Act Relating to Vehicle Sales and Use Tax, sponsored by Representative Ken Escobel. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 56, noes 3, absent 1.
House Bill 146 has been assigned to Committee Number 3, Revenue. House Bill 85, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 85, Teacher Suspensions, an Act Relating to Teacher Contracts, sponsored by Representative McKim. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 57, noes 2, absent 1.
House Bill 85 has been assigned to Committee Number 4, Education. House Bill 114, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 114, Insurance Premiums Failure to Pay, and Act Relating to Insurance, sponsored by Representative Ken Escobel. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 57, noes 1, absent 1.
House Bill 114 has been assigned to Committee Number 7, Corporations. House Bill 177, first reading of the House Bill.
House Bill 177, Vietnam and Veterans Welcome Home and Thank You Day, an Act Relating to State Holidays and Observances, sponsored by Representative Yagi. Pass the House on third reading. Ayes 59, absent 1.
House Bill 177 has been referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation. Reports from standing committees.
February the 3rd, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 107, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Fladern, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 2nd, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 105, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cole, Cooper, and Jennings. No, Senator Rothfuss, Senator Bebout, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 121, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Fladern, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 3rd, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred Senate File 143, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Myers, Nicholas, Peterson, Von Flatern, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 2nd, 2011, Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, to whom was referred House Bill 124, engrossed, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Cooper, Johnson, Landon, Nutting, and Schiffer, Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
Bill's on second reading. Senate File 113, second reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 113, Surveyor Engineers Practice Acts Revision, sponsored by Senator Johnson.
There is an amendment, the Johnson Amendment. Senator Johnson, would you like to move that amendment and talk about it at this time, please?
Well, thank you, Mr. President. I move second reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 113.
Senator Johnson, I neglected to ask the clerk to read that amendment, and we'd ask him to read that in at this time. Thank you.
Off. Senate File 113, Second Reading Amendment 1, page 46, line 18.
Now you may go ahead and move the amendment, Senator Johnson. We apologize.
Thank you, Mr. President. I would move Second Reading Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 113. And to follow this, you need to get out Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 13 that was passed yesterday, and look down on the bottom of page 1 and the top of page 2, line 44, an officer or employee of the state of Wyoming practicing within the scope of his authority and employment, except when filing water rights or water right petitions with the state of Wyoming, as provided in Title 41 of the Wyoming statutes. What the amendment does, Mr. President, is that it, at the bottom of, on bottom page 1, line 45, it deletes practicing and inserts performing regulatory reviews. The reason for this amendment is simply to tighten up the exemption for state employees. While there is and has been an exemption for federal employees, there never has been one for state employees until now. And that exemption should only apply in a focused way. Primarily, the intent of the new section and the second reading amendment is to make sure we have licensed professional engineers where we need them in state government, but also not binding agencies' hands by requiring licensed PEs for routine work such as permit or application review, simply to assure compliance with rules. Many technicians who do such work are not engineers at all. The language in this amendment was, on reflection, too broad and needed to be sharpened this way. This amendment clarifies that the exemption only applies to employees performing regulatory reviews and not to all engineering or technical positions in the state. It's a good amendment, Mr. President, tightens it up, separates engineers from engineering technicians doing reviews, and I would ask for your favorable vote.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I'd like to ask us to think about this a minute. It does tighten it up. I wonder if it covers all the other things these technicians, in fact, do in the state engineer's office and other places, and if the implications of this amendment are that we're going to have to hire additional engineers, which has obvious budget implications, and I'm trying to get the Appropriations Committee to pay attention and make sure we're indulging in a little creep here in the expense of our state government.
Other comments? Senator Case.
Mr. President, thank you very much. I'm trying to recall the discussion in committee. We did talk about the issue of state employees performing some of these functions and that they should be exempted. I'm a little hesitant to further go beyond the language of the Standing Committee Amendment at this time. I think we need some fairly broad exceptions for state employees that do this kind of work in the course of their duties and have never come under the Act before. I would hate to think that maybe we would be beginning down a road there, and that was not our intent. It was to keep the bill from undermining other people doing this work. So I'd like a little bit more time to speak about it. I've not talked to the sponsor about it or the folks sponsoring the bill, and I guess I'd like to hear that firsthand before we put this on.
Other comments before the sponsor takes his second shot? Senator Johnson, would you like to go at this time?
Thank you, Mr. President. If there's problems with this amendment and questions that need to be answered, let's kill it. Let's get the questions answered. We can certainly bring it back on third reading tomorrow.
With that question being called in regard to third reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 113, all those in favor of this amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
That amendment has failed. We are now back on the bill. Any further commentary in regard to the bill? Senate File 113 having been read 2 separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objections, it is so ordered. Senate File 118, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 118, Career and Technical Training Grant, sponsored by Senator Hastert.
There are no amendments. Seeing no comments, Senate File 118, having been read 2 separate times, the question is, shall a bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Senate File 131, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 131, Military Department, Federally Funded Positions, sponsored by Senator Schiffer.
There are no amendments. Senate File 131, having been read 2 separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objections, it is so ordered. Senate File 132, second reading of the bill.
Senate File 132, Strangulation of a Household Member, sponsored by Senator Hastert.
There are some amendments, and I'd ask the reading clerk to read in the First Amendment, the Christensen Amendment, at this time.
Senate File 132, Second Reading Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 16.
Senator Christensen, would you like to move this amendment? Speak to it at this time.
Mr. President, I move Second Amendment Reading Number 1, Senate File 132. Urge the body to give a favorable recommendation. Mr. President, if you'll direct your attention, I'll just get right to it. On page 1, line 16, after the statute 3521-102, insert with intent to intimidate or terrorize the household member. Mr. President, members of the Senate, in studying this, this was a concern for me on that. How do we establish the intent? I think this amendment goes to that. While it is a difficult, or it can be a difficult bar, we've had input from folks who said it was too high a bar, other folks who said they could work with it. I guess my concern is that there is some kind of a level playing field or some opportunity for those accused to be able to respond, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. President. I rise on and against the amendment, Mr. President, and then for a couple of reasons. I think that raising this to, you know, putting the intent language is in, has unintended consequences in itself. It unnecessarily raises on the intent language. You know, it was mentioned on the floor yesterday or the other day that a husband could have bad judgment and throw his arm around his wife's neck to restrain her and be guilty of strangulation. And then, Mr. President, I submit to the body that there is intent language in the bill today. Under the law as written, the state would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he threw his arm around the neck with the intent to strangle her or intent to cut off her air or blood supply. So there really is intent language there. You have to, they'll have to show that there's intent to do that, Mr. President. And also, if you take a look at 62502, and that's subsection 4, it says it's aggravated assault and battery penalty, and intentionally, knowing, or recklessly causes bodily injury to the woman whom he knows is pregnant. Well, Mr. President, I think if you can substitute strangulation in there, the argument's in essence the same. We're not saying that he has that there has intent to cause a miscarriage, simply that he that there was an intent to hurt and strike a pregnant woman. Mr. President, there is also an amendment that I have right in behind this one that certainly I'm hoping would take care of and alleviate a lot of the concerns because, Mr. You know, it talks about the sections to not apply where conduct and injury are reasonably foreseen hazards of joint participation in lawful athletic events.
Senator Hastert, I would urge you to address the First Amendment.
I'm sorry, Mr. President, that's accurate. Anyway, Mr. President, on the first one here, the fact that there is the arguments on consent, or you know, the discussion about wrestling with one's siblings, there's already a defensible position on that, and that's consent. You know, it's the same in athletic sporting events and whatnot. So, and consent, Mr. President, is you know, a defendable position. So, with the fact that, you know, realistically, there's intent in the bill, there's intent that you have, that they'll have to show intent to cut off the blood supply or air supply. I feel that, and I feel that there's already protection in there.
Further commentary before the sponsor of the amendment rises for his second time. Senator Scott.
Mr. President, I'm concerned about this bill, recalling the discussion in Committee of the Whole, that there wasn't, as the bill was brought to us, an adequate requirement for showing a criminal intent here, and that the bill would either have constitutional problems or would result in some pretty innocent people being threatened with a 10-year felony. And it appears this amendment is seeking to fix that. And frankly, Mr. President, we're well out of my legal depth here. And so I'm hoping we can induce some discussion from the attorneys in the body as to whether we really need this amendment to make this bill practicable and workable or not. The bill before us without the amendment does use the word on page 1, line 14, a person guilty of strangulation if he intentionally and knowingly, et cetera, impedes. So there is some element of intent there, but it may not I don't know whether it's the necessary criminal intent or not. This one clearly gives you, you've got to prove an intent of something that would I think, give you the necessary criminal intent, but is it a step too far? My inclination is to be on the safe side and support the amendment, but Mr. President, this is, as I say, it's well beyond my legal knowledge, and I'm trying to grapple with the concepts involved here, and could sure use some enlightenment.
Senator Netting.
Mr. President, I would like to speak against this amendment. I think that it is asking that we look into somebody's mind and try to determine their intent. And I think in cases of household battery, that the intent to terrorize is not there. And in fact, the act is not seen as terrorizing because the perpetrator said that it in no way was a terror act because he was in full control of his actions and did not see them as being terrible or terrorizing. Whereas to the person who is being terrorized, it is indeed an act of terror. So that even if the perception on the perpetrator is not that it is terrorizing, it is to the victim.
Other commentary before Senator Christensen takes his final shot? Seeing none, I guess, Senator Christensen, you can have your final opportunity here.
President, I really appreciate the this bill and the what it's trying to get at. But when I go back, again, to the plain language of it, and that, as was raised by the good senator from Natrona, if he intentionally and knowingly impedes or attempts to impede the normal breathing or circulation of blood of a household member, and then when we go over to the top of two, applying pressure on the throat or neck of the household member or blocking the nose or mouth of the household member, that plain language is very broad. And we talked the other day about how do we get around two teenage brothers or teenage siblings wrestling at home, or some other situations where it could be consensual. We talked about consent. It's not necessarily in here. Down in what was C, it referred to religious practices, and the example was given that in one very well-known and respected religion in Wyoming, or in the world, I'll just, anyway, that the act of baptism involved the adult putting their hand over the nose and the mouth before putting them underwater. And how, if that's a family member, by that plain language, it's in there. And so, rather than try to address these and come up with the exceptions, as paragraph C tried to do, it just seems like that intent, as proposed the language here, to with the intent to intimidate or terrorize. I absolutely believe that the intent of this whole bill is to address those or to deal with those people who are trying to terrorize their victims. And that is probably the best word in here, and I think that's an important word in keeping in this, and this amendment does that, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you. The question is regard to second reading amendment number 1 to Senate file 132. All those in favor of this amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Division being called, all those in favor please of this amendment, please stand. That amendment has passed. Back on the bill, back on the next amendment. The next amendment is the Hastert Amendment. I'd ask that the reading clerk read that amendment in at this time, please.
Senate File 132, second reading amendment number 2, page 2 after line 10.
Senator Hassel, would you like to move this amendment at this time?
Mr. President, I respectfully withdraw this amendment at this time.
That amendment has been withdrawn at the request of the sponsor. We're now back on the bill. Seeing no further discussion on the bill, House Bill 132 having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Senate File 135, second reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 135, University of Wyoming, Federal Mineral Royalty, sponsored by Senator Nicholas.
There is an amendment, and it's the BBOT amendment, and I'd ask the reading clerk read that amendment in at this time.
Senate File 135, second reading amendment number 1, page 3, line 5.
Senator BBOT, would you like to move this amendment and speak to it at this time?
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, member of the Senate, I move second reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 135. Member of the Senate, if you look at this bill and what it does, it talks about the federal mineral royalties and how they come to the university, and of course that's something that flows directly to the university, and some language changes. And the purpose of this amendment is I wanted to be sure that if you look at page 3, payments from this revenue shall be made by the state treasurer only for expenditures approved by the trustee of the university. And I didn't want to have any of these funds, if these payments came back from these federal mineral royalties, if they were in fact used to guarantee bonds, that they would have in fact any capital construction projects. So the purpose of the amendment is to say that provided that expenditures for capital construction projects shall only be for projects authorized by the legislature. So these funds would not be utilized for capital construction unless we, the legislature, authorize them. I would ask for your favorable consideration.
Comments, questions of the sponsor? Seeing none, question before us is in regard to second reading amendment number 1 to Senate File 135. All those in favor of this amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
That amendment has passed. Back on the bill, there are no further amendments. Senate File 135, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Senate File 147, second reading of the Senate file.
Senate File 147, Service of Process Fees, sponsored by Senator Dockstader.
There are no amendments. Senate File 147, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Senate Joint Resolution 7, second reading of the Senate Joint Resolution.
Senate Joint Resolution 7, Bark Beetle Mitigation, sponsored by Senator Dockstader.
There are no amendments. Senate Joint Resolution number 7, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. We are now on bills, third reading and final passage. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, do you have a consent list?
Mr. President, third reading consent list for today is as follows. Senate File 95, Legislative Committee Membership. Senate File 134, Liens. Senate File 137, Ignition Interlock Devices. And Senate File 138, Child Custody Orders Abandonment.
Would anyone like any of these bills removed from the consent list? Seeing no one rise, having been read three separate times, the question is, shall these bills pass the Senate? Senate File 95, Senate File 134, Senate File 137, Senate File 138. The Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Barnard.
Aye.
Bebout.
Aye.
Burns.
Aye.
Case.
Aye.
Christensen.
Aye.
Coe.
Aye.
Cooper.
Aye.
Dockstader.
Aye.
Driscoll.
Aye.
Emmerich.
Aye.
Esquivel.
Aye.
Geis.
Aye.
Hastert.
Aye.
Hicks.
Aye.
Hines.
Aye.
Jennings.
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Landon.
Aye.
Martin.
Aye.
Meyer.
Aye.
Nicholas.
Aye.
Nutting.
Aye.
Perkins.
Aye.
Peterson.
Aye.
Ross.
Aye.
Rothfuss.
Aye.
Schiffer.
Aye.
Scott.
Aye.
Von Platern.
Aye.
President Anderson.
Aye.
30 ayes. Senate File 95. Are there any changes? Case I to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 95. 29 ayes, 1 no. Senate File 134. Are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 134, 30 ayes. Senate File 137, are there any changes? Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 137, 30 ayes. Senate File 138, are there any changes? Barnard, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. Senate File 138. 29 ayes. 29 ayes, 1 no.
Having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the Senate, Senate File 95, Senate File 134, Senate File 137, Senate File 138 have passed the Senate. Other bills on third reading, final. Senate Joint Resolution 1, this is the third reading of the Senate Joint Resolution.
Senate Joint Resolution 1, right to hunt, fish, and trap. Sponsored by Senator Hicks. Be it enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
There is an amendment. It's the Hicks and Bebout Amendment, and I would ask that the reading clerk read this amendment in at this time, please.
Senate Joint Resolution 1, third reading amendment number 1, page 1, line 2.
Senator Hicks, would you like to move and speak to this amendment at this time, please?
Mr. President, if I may move this amendment, I'd like to discuss the intent of the amendment. What this is designed to do is substantially reduce the potential for unintended consequences. The second component of this amendment is also to affirm the state's ownership of wildlife. Now, if I can walk you through specifically what this amendment does, if you go to page 1, line 2, after the word by, it inserts, provided that all wildlife in Wyoming is the property of the state. In reviewing both our constitutions and our statutes with the attorneys, what we basically found out, while there's case law that reaffirms that wildlife is a property of the state, we have statutes that reaffirm that, but there's nothing enshrined in our constitution that affirms that wildlife is a property of the state. So that's the first part of that, getting to that affirmation of the ownership of the wildlife within the state of Wyoming. The second one is if you'll go to page 1, line 3, and this amends the Landon Amendment, and it inserts the opportunity in exchange for the word right. The way that will now read, it says, Wyoming citizens' opportunity to hunt, fish, and trap wildlife. If you go to page 2, line 1, this will be the actual title listed under Article 1, Section 3 in the state constitution. We would delete the word right and insert ownership of wildlife and opportunity. So that would read Article 1, Section 3, ownership of wildlife, opportunity to hunt, fish, and trap would be the new language that would go into the Constitution. We go down to page 2, line 3, again, amending the Senate Joint Resolution Amendment 2. We insert the words, all wildlife in Wyoming is the property of the state, delete right, and insert opportunity. So what that would do is now it will read, all wildlife in Wyoming is the property of the state. The opportunity to hunt, fish, and trap wildlife is a heritage that shall ever be preserved to the individual citizens of the state, subject to regulation as prescribed by law. The next amendment, if you go to page 2, line 14, after will, insert, and this is the actual language that would show up on the ballot. If you go down to there, on line 14, it says the adoption of this amendment will provide that all wildlife in Wyoming is the property of the state, recognize and preserve the heritage of Wyoming citizens, insert the word opportunity to hunt, fish, and trap wildlife subject to regulation as prescribed by law. I would ask for your favorable consideration and move the amendment, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. President.
Thank you. Senator Meyer.
President, just some clarification. I'm not sure whether the regulation, subject to regulation, provides what we need to have. We currently have bird farms in the state, and the process is that you buy all of the pheasants on your ranch as a census that the Game and Fish has, and then you have a 210-day hunting season. And I just want to make sure that we put this in the Constitution, those type of things can still go. I'm thinking maybe they can, but I'd really like to know for sure as far as the intent. So I don't make a mistake on voting aye for this one.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. President. Having played around with those statutes a couple of years ago, I believe what this would do is the wildlife would still be the property of the state, but because of the statute that we have on game bird farms, we're giving that permission back to those individuals to farm them and sell them what they do with them. So hopefully that would answer your question.
I believe Senator Scott rose first. Senator Scott.
Mr. President, this amendment would be divisible if we need to. My inclination is to support it because I think that the state ought to have its regulation of wildlife on firm ground, and we shouldn't ought to have privately owned wildlife. The question I have, just to make sure we aren't doing something we don't intend. Wildlife's property of the state. My alfalfa crop is my property. The state's property eats my property. Would you will? Is there a potential for a constitutional right then for compensation? And I don't think we want to inadvertently create a constitutional right in that purpose. So I would ask, this is third reading, Mr. President. I would ask some of the other members of the Senate who might be more knowledgeable in some of these things to think about that issue, to enlighten us a little bit. I think what we're doing is a good idea, Mr. President, but because it's a constitutional amendment on third reading, I think we ought to be sure about it. It looks and sounds good to me, but let's be a little ultra careful and that we don't get an unintended consequence right there.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. I guess just to draw on that, I think that there's at least one private elk herd that was its grandfather from years ago up in the north. There are folks that stock their own ponds with fish. I'm not certain whether those fish would be really considered the wildlife of the state. I suppose if you've got fish in your fishbowl in your house, maybe those are wildlife. I'm not certain. I remember when we were growing up as children, we had a variety of our neighbors had a couple skunks that were their pets. I could think of turtles that were, we used to have those big turtles, you put a hook in them. There are a lot of things out there that one wonders when you do this, and I think it takes some, it is true that we want to have the right to regulate, so even if you had a grandfathered elk herd, we have an interest in making sure that they don't get introduced to our herds, things like that. And I don't know that we'd want to let any more, allow any more to occur. But on a third reading amendment, we just need to take a step back and say, do we know enough to make that adoption that quickly?
Senator Hines.
Mr. President, if I'm not mistaken, I'm aware of two deeds to wildlife that people in the state of Wyoming has. And I'm wondering just how this would affect those, that people that had deeds to wildlife in the past and continually had these wildlife on private lands. Is there a problem there when we institution that? I don't know, but I'm asking that as a question and to bring it up.
Senator Bebout, are you about to rise? Senator Esquibel.
President, that brings up a question in my mind. Would buffalo be wildlife? Thank you.
Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. President. Good questions. And when we talked about this early this morning, particularly about all the wildlife shall be the property of the state and put in our Constitution, it is in our statutes presently. And I thought, quite frankly, that it was in our Constitution, and I tried to find it and could not find it. And we had a discussion in Travel and Rec the other day about having the constitutional right that all wildlife is protected, and that might be a position for the state to take, given what's happening in our state with the wolves and the bears. But it's not. And I think that it's something, since case law already supports that, and if we look at the judicial activism that's going on in this country relative to what they're trying to do to us and we manage our own wildlife, I thought it made a lot of sense to put it in there. The questions about the fish in your pond, you know, under the current statutes in Wyoming, that those fish are the property of the state. That doesn't preclude you as an owner of that private property and the owner of the pond to go down to Colorado, which some people do, and buy the fish and plant them in there. It doesn't preclude you from being able to fish for them with the rights guaranteed by the Game and Fish. But to say that they're your own property, even though you purchase them under existing law, they really aren't yours. This will change that in terms of being in the Constitution rather than in the statutes. And I think we in Wyoming have to make a position, take a position that the wildlife does belong to the state as we move forward on this. The other thing, Mr. President, is I looked at the word right. If you look at Article 1, and there's 38 different things we do in Article 1 in our Constitution, and it's a right to bear arms. It's a right to a due process. It's a right to trial. It's a lot of rights. And yet, if you talk about the right to hunt, fish, and trap, then I think you've elevated that to a higher level versus the word opportunity. And I could see a potential conflict between different rights that would be satisfied by going to court, and that the judicial part of our system would decide what that right is and how these rights affect each other. So I like the word opportunity rather than right. This is a very, very important thing, and we already have two constitutional amendments have gone out. This would be a third, and I don't take these things lightly. The comments made, and certainly it was not intended to get involved and change things that have existed for a long time or take away what rights we already have. I think what we're doing here is taking existing statute, putting the Constitution, and protecting this right for Wyoming forever. And if we get into a situation where instead of case law supporting it, case law could change. And I think that the wildlife in Wyoming belong to the people of Wyoming. I think it's a good idea.
Senator Scott, I believe this is your second time. Go ahead.
Mr. President, as I understand our rules, if we divide the amendment, then people will have an opportunity to speak twice on each division. And for that reason, Mr. President, to get a full discussion on this particular issue, I'm going to ask that the amendment be divided, with Division 1 being the issue of the wildlife being the property of the state. So it would be the page 1, line 2 reference. In the page 2, line 3 reference, it would be the words, "Before thee, insert all wildlife in Wyoming as the property of the state." And the page 2, line 14 reference. And the balance of the amendment would be the issue of deleting right and inserting opportunity. I believe, Mr. President, it is divisible that way, and that would give us an opportunity to fully explore the implications of this before we vote on it.
Senator Scott, let me repeat this back to you in order to verify your intention. What you've requested is in reference to page line or page 1, line 2, which would be lines 2, 3, and 4 of the amendment. That would be a portion of the first division. The second portion of the first division would then go down to lines 19 through 21 of the amendment and would include page 2, line 14, and the language therein. So those two portions would be division 1.
Mr. President,
all right.
Plus the words on lines 14, 15, and 16, the words, "Before thee, insert all wildlife in Wyoming as the property of the state."
And that then would be included?
That would be included in the first division.
In the first division.
The other words on lines 14 through 17 relate to the other issue. And, Mr. President, the way that it's drafted, they are separable that way.
Well, I believe it is divisible. I think that then what we're looking at, and our first vote would be on the first division. First division would be line of the amendment, lines 2, 3, and 4 of the amendment. Then going into the words within lines 13, 14, and 15, including the words, "Before the insertion, all wildlife in Wyoming is the property of the state." And then the final portion of the first division would include those words on lines 19 to 21 of the amendment. I will then call the question on that first division. Is there any further conversation in regard to this first division? Senator Perkins.
Chairman, just a question for the sponsors, and as thumbing through the statutes, and I'm not finding that wildlife, at least so far, is actually the property of the state, but simply the state has the opportunity to regulate and preserve wildlife. And so my question would be, and it was a question that's been kind of, we've talked around it, but the other question would be, I'm just wondering, what's the significance or the intent with respect to declaring wildlife to be the property of the state instead of recognizing that the wildlife belongs to the people of the state. And it may be to me, that's a fairly significant distinction, and I think goes to some of the issues on just compensation and some other things. But maybe there's a difference without a distinction. But as they talk about that, I'd be interested in their thoughts on that idea.
I'm going to call on Senator Burns, and then since you're the sponsor of the amendment, Senator Hicks will come to you later. Senator Burns, would you like to address this first division of this amendment?
Mr. President, I'd actually like to address the global thing. I would ask that we lay back this bill for one day. There are a number of questions that have arisen over this, not the least of which was the good question raised by my good compatriot from Albany County over wildlife and the fact that I had forgotten there actually is a private game ranch within the state of Wyoming, and would a constitutional amendment thereby outlaw that, which is currently in statute. I think some of the provisions of the definition of wildlife and so forth, I think we should take an extra day and and take a look at that so we know exactly what we're doing. And, Mr. Chairman, the relation to the first division of the amendment is if we vote on that, then we vote on the second, then we're voting on the entire bill.
Well, Senator Burns, given the nature of this third reading of a critical question in regard to a Senate joint resolution, would you put your request in a form of a motion and then we'll vote on it in regard to laying this back?
Mr. President, I move that we lay this bill back for one day.
Thank you. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Senate, that motion carries. Senate Joint Resolution 1 will be laid back until third reading tomorrow. Consideration bills on general file. Mr. Majority Leader, Floor Leader, we are at the order of business for considerations of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself into committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. Senator Von Fladeren, would you come take the helm, please?
Committee of the Whole, please come to order. We're still on Senate files, so please be kind. First bill for our consideration is Senate File 52. Will the reading clerk please read it in?
Senate File 52, Teacher Tenure, an Act Relating to Education, sponsored by Senator Cole. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Cole, Jennings, and Landon. No, Senator Barnard and Rothfuss, Senator Coe, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Senator Coe.
Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole Rise and Report. Do you have me turned on?
Yeah, it says you are, Senator Coe. Well, look, your microphone's on, Senator Coe.
Move the one to committee the whole rise and report to do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 52. There is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that that be read in.
The clerk, please read it.
You're going to have a Tony moment.
Senate File 52, standing committee amendment number one. To substitute bill number one. Substitute bill number one for Senate File 52 do pass.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, the substitute bill, and that's the bill we'll be working off of, and I'll try to go through quickly the differences between the original Senate File 52.
Senator Coe, would you move amendment number one?
I'd move that amendment.
Thank you.
What we did when we had Senate File 52 drafted up, and I first really saw it in December, it was a very, very poor draft, and staff even admitted it. And so when we got down here, we totally rebuilt it, and what you see is substitute bill number one. Now, when we went to committee, we voted immediately in committee to work off of this substitute bill. So we passed that immediately. Now, what it does, some of the differences in it, both of the versions eliminate continuing contract status, but the substitute goes in and defines with definition, defines dismissal as termination of the teacher contract prior to the end of the school year, defines termination as a school board's decision not to offer a contract for the next school year, and defines a probationary teacher as one employed for 3 years or less. Now, remember, we're talking in this bill, we use probationary teachers and non-probationary teachers. We've gone into the statutes and changed that from the initial contract teacher. The substitute bill provides that only probationary teachers may be terminated for just cause. The substitute bill provides that non-probationary teachers may be terminated for any reason not prohibited by law, but requires the school board to provide in writing the reasons for the termination. In the substitute bill as well, it provides full evidentiary hearings to any teacher suspended without pay, no hearing to a teacher suspended with pay, and only a non-evidentiary hearing before the school board for termination non-renewals. The substitute, rather than using May 1st, uses July 1st as the effective date. The substitute bill also allows a school board to designate at any time they want to a probationary teacher as non-probationary at any time. Then at the end of the substitute bill, you'll see a statement of legislative intent, and that basically says that no property right is being created, and the act is necessary for the public peace, health, and safety. Now, that's the difference in the standing committee bill, the substitute bill as you see it. That's the bill we worked off of from the get-go in committee. Try to answer questions on the substitute bill that we worked off of and that you have in front of you, and I'd ask that you support the amendment.
Okay, on the floor is standing committee number one, amendment to Senate File 52.
Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, question for the Chairman of Education. What is the criteria? How do you get to the two different hearings? One without pay, where you have full evidentiary hearing, and one when it's with pay, and then you're limited in your hearing. What justifies the difference?
Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, for that, when I actually go through the bill, because I think I can do it better at that point in time if the majority floor leader is comfortable with that.
Good on that. Any question on Standing Committee number 1, Senate File 52? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing Committee 1 has passed Committee of the Whole. And Senator Coe, we have another amendment, or would you like to explain the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to explain the bill. You'll see in your folder that there are actually 4 Committee of the Whole amendments, and I'd like to take those up after we've had discussion on the bill. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like to elaborate a little bit at length about what's going on here. As you all probably know, the Select Committee on School Finance, or recalibration as we know it, started meeting in April. We had 2-day meetings every month from April till December. As we got into recalibration, and this was different than in 05, those that were around in 05 and we recalibrated in 05, as directed by the Supreme Court every 5 years, we came in and totally rebuilt the model. We had a model in place back then that nobody could figure out. You couldn't, I think it was called MAP, and we wanted to develop a transparent model where you could see the moving parts. Districts, people involved in education could see how different components and their block grant was funded. As we started this process, as required by law 5 years later, we, in the meantime, before we started this process, we realized that what we'd done for education funding in this state was incredible. We have literally doubled, more than doubled education funding. 1997, we were at $567 million a year. We're at about $1.4 billion today. And from 1997 to today, we went down significantly in numbers of students. In the process of doing that, as well as we increased funding for the model, we started paying teachers a lot better. Today, as you look at it today, our teachers in the state of Wyoming, far and away the highest in the region, if you compare them on a nationwide comparison with cost of living figured in, we rank as high as number 1 in some surveys. So we've come in and plowed a whole bunch of new money into education. So as we get into the recalibration process here in the interim, we decided pretty much from the get-go that we were going to do some technical corrections to the model. Started with a tutorial that we had in April with the WIN network. And guess what our focus shifted to? Our focus shifted to accountability. The good chairman of appropriations, Mr. President, myself, and the good senator from Gillette, who's sitting up there in the chair with the reflection, were involved in this process. we turn almost exclusively, probably 75 to 80% of what we talked about in recalibration shifted to accountability. So what we created was, and you'll see it on Monday, you'll see Senate File 70. This is the Accountability Act that does go in and talk about accountability. I'm not going to talk much about the bill because I'm on this bill, but I want to tell you they're both connected. They're both related. So, as we continued our discussion on accountability, this issue reared its head. If we're really serious about accountability in education, let's lay all the apples on the table and look at all of them. That's why you see this issue. Now, with that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'll try to walk you through the bill. We'll get right into the bill. I know we'll have a lively discussion. I've got four committee of the whole amendments, I think, strengthen the bill. And with that, I'll start walking you through the bill. Mr. Chairman, as you get into the bill, in the substitute bill we're working off of, and I want to say one thing before we start this. I think there was some bad information put out there. There was a lot of the emails we got were reflective of what was in the white bill or Senate File 52. A lot of my emails said there's no due process. There is due process in this bill. Make no mistake about it. So, Mr. Chairman, as I start walking you through the bill, page 2, we talk about the duties of the board. That's the local school board to establish teacher performance guidelines for non-probationary teachers. That's all on page 2. Page 3 gets into the definitions, and I think this is a fairly important part of what we're going to talk about today. Dismissal means the termination of any teacher's contract of employment by the board prior to the end of the school year. Suspension with pay means the removal of a teacher from the classroom during the school year without termination of salary. Termination means the failure of the board of trustees of the school district to offer a teacher employed by the district a contract for the ensuing year. Suspension without pay, this means the removal of a teacher from the classroom with the termination of salary in effect. Probationary teacher, this is the teacher that is on probation for the first 3 years that they're employed. That's exactly what that means. Going to the bottom of page 4, this talks about salaries paid by the local boards and that decision made locally. Page 5 is where we start the employment of teachers. The probationary, a teacher who has taught in the system continuously for a period of at least 90 days, shall be hired on an annual contract basis. That's been deceiving, as a lot of people have read that, but that means exactly that. If you've been employed for 90 days, you can get a contract now. A probationary teacher's employment may be terminated for any reason not specifically prohibited by law. That's probationary teachers. Moving over to page 6. This is where we get into the recommendation of termination of non-probationary teachers. The time frame involved before April 15th. This is where the teacher may request a hearing. Teacher can request a hearing in this particular instance. As we move to page 7, reasons for suspending, dismissing, or terminating. Any teacher dismissed or suspended without pay is entitled to a hearing. There's a time frame involved. There's a 7-day time frame. Within 5 days, I think the superintendent and the teacher select a hearing officer if, in fact, this is the avenue that's followed. Page 8 is the time frame for a hearing for contested case proceedings. It talks about those time frames on page 8. In no event shall the hearing commence on a date later than 45 days after notice. It goes into all that. Bottom of page 8, time frame for the hearing again. Let's see here. Teacher has the right to appear in person with or without counsel. All evidence bearing on proposed dismissal or suspension without pay, the superintendent has the burden of proof of proving that. That suspension without pay or dismissal is based upon reasons. Page 9, that's where the board reviews the findings and makes a ruling. That's the local school board. They have that option. They could even retain the teacher if they want to at that point in time. Page 10, paragraph H talks about the termination and the hearing before the board. Now, remember, on termination, this bill only provides for a hearing in front of the school board. That's on page 10, paragraph H. Time frames in paragraph J, page 12 is the process whereby you can appeal to the district court. You have the option in there also, if you want, with a local decision to provide a hearing for a probationary teacher. Remembering, and then paragraph P, you'll see there where suspension without pay, you get no hearing. So that's the bill. That's a breakdown quickly of the bill. This is an interesting debate we're about to have. And I didn't take this bill on lightly. I don't think any of us did. I've got darts in my back. I've got probably have nails in my tires. I don't know. I haven't checked my tires lately. But all the emails I got, they'll say things like, what do you have against teachers? Let me say one thing. I have nothing against teachers. I think we have wonderful teachers in our K-12 system in Wyoming. There's some wonderful teachers out there. But I can tell you that I think continuing contract status as we know it protects mediocrity in the classroom. I sincerely believe that. If you get involved in this process, there are administrators out there that have been involved in this process. Sometimes they'll take 2 years, sometimes longer to make a case. There was a case up in Natrona County that went on. Went on for 18 months. 18 months cost the local district, I heard, somewhere around $135,000 before it was over. So I'm saying that I think that continuing contract status, or tenure as we know it, and I submit to this body, protects mediocrity in the classroom. One of the things I learned, the theme of this book that the good senator from Evanston over there gave me, Waiting for Superman, one of the things I learned there in this book, there was a theme through that all the way. The theme was student achievement can be driven consistently, no matter if you're dealing with at-risk kids, whatever kids you're dealing with quality teachers in the classroom. That's one of the themes that was evident throughout that whole book. So I stand in front of you. We've done some wonderful things in accountability with education over the years. I would speak of national board certification, recommendations after 05 for instructional facilitators that we fund. We're doing great things out there for accountability. I can tell you, I think this bill follows closely on the heels of all that accountability. And I'd urge that you support the bill. I think it's time we had the discussion. I think it's imperative that we have this discussion. If we're really, really serious about accountability in K-12, I'd ask that you support the bill.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a couple of questions that are really outside the accountability aspect and just wanting to make sure that things are working. What is the effect of this bill? Suppose you have a circumstance where, say, a school district has lost a lot of population, major employer in the district closed, a lot of families moved out, and get your budget to balance, you've got to lay off, dismiss some teachers who have been there for more than 3 years. It's just a simple matter of the students are no longer there. Hopefully our economies will all flourish and it won't happen. But it could, and the school board's got to balance the budget. What impact does this bill have on how you proceed in those circumstances? That's That's the first question. The second question relates to the definition on page 3, suspension with pay. Means removal of a teacher from a classroom during school year without termination of salary. Suppose you need to move a teacher, and maybe very much with the teacher's consent, either from the classroom for, say, half the year, but so that teacher can conduct a project, maybe with relation to revamping a curriculum or something. You're moving them to administrative post temporarily. There's no, you may be doing it to your best teacher to get the advantage, or teacher gets sick, isn't in position to perform well enough in the classroom, you move them to an administrative job for a year or for a shorter period as a humane way of dealing with a real problem and hope that they will be back teaching full blast in the classroom next year. Do you have to suspend them with pay, or is there another mechanism for doing that sort of thing, which I submit to you, that kind of circumstance will arise.
Center office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My colleague from Park County has basically said that what we need to do in our approach to looking at teacher accountability is to lay all the apples on the table, and I know that we're going to do that. But I would tell the Senate right now that this is the bad apple. This is the apple that we want to make sure that we remove from the process. We have a couple of very good bills that are coming our way. One of them is on teacher accountability. Another is on educational accountability. And I believe that we're going to accomplish
all of our office, would you keep it on this bill, please?
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Chairman. We're going to accomplish those objectives through that legislation. And I'd like to say that on this particular piece of legislation, what we're doing is we're basically trying to go too far. We've identified a problem that is a real problem. There's no question that there are bad teachers out there. I think everyone in here has probably heard of a case or two where you have a teacher that's underperforming and that it's difficult for the district to actually get rid of that teacher. So the bar right now, as my colleague has indicated, is too high. It's too difficult. Unfortunately, what this bill is going to do is take the bar far too low to the point where we have arbitrary, capricious terminations of teachers, not for reasons related to their educational performance, but perhaps related to other personal relationships or difficulties that they're having in the school. So what we're going to end up seeing through this arbitrary nature, where we're taking the bar down so low that you're simply terminated because the administrator at the school doesn't like you or feels individually that you're underperforming, if you don't have the appropriate due process in place, you'll have that arbitrary nature. Now, the types of teachers that really end up being difficult for administrators are the teachers that are very bad and the teachers that are very good. Those are the two types of teachers that are difficult for administrators. They cause problems. They challenge the administrators in various ways. Obviously, we want to empower the administrator with the ability to get rid of the bad teacher, but we don't want to empower the administrator with the ability to get rid of the good teacher. And I think what this bill is effectively going to do, as my colleague said, right now the system may protect mediocrity, but I think if we go too far, we're going to ensure mediocrity. Because the teachers will not want to stick their neck out. They will not want to challenge the system. They will not want to think innovatively. Instead, what they'll want to do, Mr. Chairman, is just get by. Protect their job. I don't think we want to put a teacher in a situation where every single year, at the end of the year, they're up for termination unless it's signed off that they get another year. That's a significant concern. What we lack right now that I've heard, the primary problem is that we don't have accountability because we don't have accurate data. It's difficult for the administrators to put together a case under the current system that substantiates their claims that the teacher is underperforming. And that's the reason that we need to have accountability. That's the reason that we need to have things in place that can provide a measuring stick for the performance of that teacher. And that's what we're talking about, Mr. Chairman, when we're looking at a lot of the other legislation. I think we should empower the administrators and the school districts at this point in time with the proper measuring tools before we just take away any job security for our teachers. We have all heard from teachers in the teaching community that they think that this bill goes too far, and Mr. Chairman, I would agree with that. The final point I'd like to make before I sit down is a bit of a different point about how this bill approaches its solution. This bill substantially changes the contract that is currently in place between the state and the teachers. They're under continuing contract at this point if they've been around for more than 3 years. In the Wyoming State Constitution, Article 1, Section 35, there's a little clause that says ex post facto laws impairing obligation of contracts. No ex post facto law, nor any law impairing the obligation of contracts, shall ever be made. If ever there was a case where we're going back and rewriting a contract, this, Mr. Chairman, is that case. We are taking a situation where all of the teachers currently employed in the state of Wyoming who are under what they call tenure or what they call continuing contract are now going to have that contract rewritten by this legislature if this bill passes. And that, Mr. Chairman, is fundamentally unconstitutional. I don't believe it would survive a legal challenge. Mr. Chairman, I believe we should look for alternatives. We should look for accountability. But this is the bad apple. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to try to address the good senator from Natrona County's questions first, and then I think I have some more to say here. The effect, I think, that the good senator asked if a district lost population, and we went through this a lot. We saw a steady decline. We had the highest ADM I remember seeing since I've been around here was 1991 or two. We got up to 102,000. We actually went all the way down to 82,000. We're now back up to about 87,000. I think the thing to remember here is that the block grants are determined. The block grants are determined by the ADM. So I'm not sure that it would have an effect on the teachers if you had to lay teachers off and meet a budget. I'm not quite sure how to answer that any better than that. Define suspension with pays that might relate to, say, a teacher that becomes ill. A good teacher, but you want to keep them, hope they get better and come back into the classroom. I think that's a local decision. I think that can be done right now. So I hope I answer your questions. One of the things that the good senator from Albany County, my good friend over there, brought up, and I want to say, I don't disagree with everything you're saying. I can tell you that I don't think, when we look at what's going on out there today, we have flatlined. We put all this money into education, high salaries. We're flatlining on our performance. We're 27th in high school graduation in the country. As far as your legal argument, that's an argument for the real lawyers. But I can tell you that if that's your argument that it's part of the Constitution, that's fine. Teacher tenure came in 1967. I think I'll let other people talk. I'm going to have more to say later.
Senator Bebop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to disagree with my colleague from Albany County on some different points, and just to discuss these. And one of the comments made is that the termination is arbitrary, and there's no consideration given to that. I don't agree with that. I think the law, if this bill should move forward, will take care of that. And I don't think it's all conjecture as to it being arbitrary. I really think that there's plenty of protection in there. You know, if you look at the process that now stands, and we've all heard stories about different positions and situations in our state, but if you think about it, if you think about the process that we have set up and what has to happen in order for a person, a teacher that certainly isn't performing, and none of us want to have bad teachers, that process is at least, it's very intimidating. And when you think about going to district court and going through that process to do something, I will tell you and submit to you, and most of you have probably been in a situation where in court, the process is intimidating. I think this sets up a better process. Go to the school boards and let them be able to hear the discussion and make the decision. You know, mediocrity, I'll share a quick story with you because I, too, like my colleague from Park County, I'm extremely proud of the job in terms of what the legislature has done to fund education. He mentioned of where we fit nationally, where we are with so much money per ADM and how much we spend on our teacher salaries. I was in Colorado a couple of years ago, and I had an occasion to see a fellow colleague of ours, a senator from Colorado, and he was with a group of people, and I sat down there and was visiting with him, and And we started talking, and then one of the ladies there asked me where I was from, and I said, I was from Wyoming. And I was in the Senate. She said, you're the one. I said, what do you mean I'm the one? She said, Wyoming is taking away all our good teachers because of what you're paying. You know, it's about money in that respect, and it wasn't because they came to Wyoming because of tenure. They came to Wyoming, hey, they love our state and the opportunities here, but because of the pay. And I would submit to you the mediocrity, and if you look at pay and taking care of good teachers, which we do and we should, the pay is a big part of that. And what's wrong with having a situation where if you have a bar that sets here, and I think the bar is high. I don't think this lowers the bar. I think the bar is set high. And you have a lot of good teachers. You have some excellent teachers, and we all understand that. But if you have some teachers that, A, may not even want to be in the profession, and they're struggling to get by, and you have opportunities where the people are talking about it, that you set up a situation where the school board will make that determination, and it's not a continuing thing. They don't get in there, and they're guaranteed a job. And that's the problem I have with the situation that now exists. Let's have the school board be involved, make those kind of decisions. And I've had a lot of emails just like everybody else. And the teachers that are against this bill, I don't think they understand the new bill. I think they're looking at the old bill. This is an improvement on it. They make great arguments. But this isn't about bashing teachers. We're proud of teachers. The people that are for this bill are making the argument that why not have a situation that you let good teachers and excellent teachers excel? Why should you bring along teachers and treat them differently if they're not performing? And that, to me, is a basic difference. You know, why should anything, any situation where you have the bar is set that there's 5% of the people in that particular area are not performing, yet 95% are, and maybe 25 or 30% of that are performing extremely well, why should they carry the 5% that aren't? And I think that's what this bill gets to try to take care of that. Maybe it's 10%. Maybe it's 2%. Let's talk about changing it and doing something that's different to really work on a good thing we've got in Wyoming, which is wonderful teachers. We're committed. The legislature is committed. We're building great schools. Let's take the other component of this, and this really makes a difference. And I think if we pass this kind of legislation, I know there's other legislation out there that will help, but if we pass something like this, we'll look back and say, as tough as it was to make that decision, it made a better place in our state for our kids, for education, and for the teachers. Thank you.
President Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess the reason that I rise on this is to try to address the question from the good senator from Natrona County in regard to reduction in force. I think riffing is what you're talking about. Having gone through that process once myself, I would simply say under the scenario that's been presented by this bill, if in fact a district had a reduction in force, under this bill you would be left with, I think, a stable of very good teachers. So you look out in regard to how do you rip, you know, how do you do this reduction in force. Given the ability that's provided in this bill, you would have all very good teachers. Under the old scenario in which I underwent reduction of force, I saw where many of the continuing contract teachers are the ones that had been there lesser time than some of the more experienced continuing contract teachers were able to stay at the expense of some very, very good teachers who got released, good younger teachers. And so they just actually just went up the ladder, and regardless of how young you might be, how good a teacher you might be, you were released in a kind of a reverse order from those being less experienced on up. I think under this scenario, as I see it, like I said, the district would already have an opportunity to have weeded the garden, that would probably bring about a local policy of just starting at the bottom of a very good list of teachers, and without going in regard to trying to pick out, knowing that they're all good, then probably would then, by local control, release those lesser ones first, going on up the ladder. That process, to me, recognizes that experience does count in the profession, that experienced teachers are, in fact, of high value.
You know, we go into our communities, and I have been blessed to have spent my lifetime in what I consider a profession. I think that this bill is one that would truly, truly make teaching a profession. I've always seen it as being a profession. I won't go on in regard to anything else other than to say I think under the scenario, just directly to your question, Senator, I think that's probably what would most likely occur. Thank you.
Senator Von Platen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Speaking on and for this bill, and as you can see, I'm a co-sponsor on it, there was a lot of bad information given out over emails. And when the few that replied back to me all said, oh, I got to look at the new bill, the new version. Oh, it's not so bad. But for those that continue to send out that bad information, well, credibility is on the line for some. But I will tell you, this bill does lay out the procedure. If you went to the old statutes, it used the word continuing contract in about a dozen lines. That was pretty much what it said. You could have a hearing if you're a continuing contract teacher. You could demand or ask for this hearing and a representative to be there. And that's about it. Didn't have any time periods in it. Didn't tell you had to do this first, next person had to do this, and then they had to do this and answer you by this. This bill does that. This bill actually, if you were a layperson coming off the street into the teaching profession and you really want to know what your rights were, I think this bill lays it out for you quite nicely. So in favor of that. The other part of this is local control for boards from your local board. And this good senator, the tall senator from Natrona County, brought up some good points, answered by our president, that said reduction in force. Well, that's a local board issue. But I will tell you one great consequence of this bill, should it pass, is that last year I was going to run a bill that addressed retiring teachers and said right now they just have to retire for 30 days. So at the end of the school year they retire and they are back signed up in August, and we need that. We need that option. Well, one of the problems that we had discussed with my local school board was reduction of force after that, a year later or so. Some drastic thing happened, some major industry shut down, children were gone, had to close schools, whatever. Could that teacher now claim, who retired, claim seniority? You know, over all these new teachers, which are your future. This teacher is in there for another 1, 2, 3, or 4 years of teaching and could very well, under the old statutes, claim that they were the tenured teacher, the continuing contract teacher, and we didn't have a real answer. The statutes are unclear on that, which means you'd be laying off your future younger teachers who are there for, you're hoping, 30 years, and possibly laying them off to keep somebody that's going to go into full retirement the next year. So I think that takes care of that problem we have, too, or could have had. This lays it out quite nicely for the teachers, for us, for me to read. I ask for your favorable vote on this. Now let's move this forward, and I know there's amendments to be talked about.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still trying to understand the bill, and I need some help here. So hopefully the good chairman of education or those sponsors on this bill can help me. But I'm trying to once understand the mechanics here with regards to the difference between suspension without pay and suspension with pay. If I read the bill correctly in 21.7.110, if you're suspended without pay, you're given full-blown hearing. You get to go to a hearing officer. You get to subpoena witnesses. You get to do all of that. And it appears then, if I'm still reading this correctly, if you're not suspended without pay but with pay, then you get the hearing that's allowed to you before the board on pages 10 and 11, if I'm correct. And that hearing is a lesser kind of hearing. It's before the board. The APA doesn't apply. You don't get to subpoena witnesses. You don't get to call witnesses. You don't get to cross-examine them.
and the hearing is based on affidavits solely, and no oral testimony be taken. Am I understanding this correctly? Because it would seem to me that perhaps we have it backwards, where a teacher who is suspended without pay is probably suspended for some sort of egregious conduct, and they get the real big hearing, but the teacher that's suspended with pay gets the lesser hearing. And I'm not sure I understand that and why it is that way. So somebody please explain that to me. I'm just trying to understand it.
Senator Escobar.
Mr. Chairman, just have a couple of questions, and some very similar to questions that a good senator from Laramie County has. On page 7, it talks about the board suspending or dismissing or terminating. And I was just wondering what the difference was between a dismissal or a termination. The other comment I'd like to make is, as a good senator from Campbell County mentioned, this looks real good, you know, on its face. But the question I have is, how is it going to be implemented? How is it going to be interpreted? For example, immorality. You can be dismissed for immorality. With someone living with a couple living together without the benefit of marriage, could that be considered immorality? Two men living together, not in a sexual relationship or anything of that nature, but just rooming together. But rumors go out. Have you heard? Do you know? Would somebody question their morality? Immorality is a pretty elusive standard, Mr. Chairman. The other part would be insubordination. What constitutes insubordination? Right now we're having a big issue regarding the book by Mark Twain. There's some concern over some of the words in that book. If some teacher was to assign that as a novel for a reading exercise, and some parent complains, especially an influential parent, to the school board or the principal, and the principal says, Teacher A, don't use that book. Well, she decides to use that book, or he decides to use that book. Legally, that'd be insubordination. You place a teacher in a big bind in terms of a conflict. Does she provide the learning to her students, or does she follow whatever the principal says? Play it safe. And I'll just, and the reason my concern is it's quite high is because I'll just give you a quick story. Some years back, I was teaching at the community college, and this is at the community college. And we were going over some crime statistics in class. A couple of days later, I was called to the dean's office saying that there was a complaint about me criticizing Chief Bird. And I said, well, I wasn't criticizing Chief Bird. I was criticizing this statistics. And I said, Chief Bird even agreed with me. Well, the next comment really surprised me. And this is at the community college level. The dean said, well, Floyd, we want you to teach sociology, but we don't want you to teach anything controversial. I said, how can you teach sociology without teaching controversial subjects? And that's a concern I have, because every novel can be very controversial. And I suspect that even mathematics can be controversial at times. So anyway, those are some of my comments. But, if they can answer the question as to what is the difference between dismiss and terminate, and how would those standards of immorality and subordination be implemented? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll tackle the last ones on that. We're not putting anything in there. I mean, these are immorality and insubordination. Those are things that have been there for years. As you look out across other states, this is language that appear in contracts throughout the United States. So if you've got this fear that if you pass this bill that there's going to be this big wave of immorality charges, why haven't they happened in the past? I'd also like to address the fact that this kind of lays out really what you're going to do on different levels of a teacher not being employed again. Most of the time, it's going to be the lack of a contract for next year. And then the discussion. Now, we do have the in there about how to get rid of a teacher that there's a problem. We all hear the news. I mean, there's been those terrible teachers that may have a relationship with a student. We've had some in Wyoming that have actually been caught in the drug arena with students. I mean, that's obviously reason for immediate dismissal. Get them away from the kids. That's a legal problem, and it's a problem that we shouldn't have those kind of people around our children. But this lays it out for those teachers in that mediocre area that haven't taken advantage of an instructional facilitator or haven't taken a step out there to help themselves. We have an enormous number of programs and money available out there right now for struggling teachers, but we need to identify them. If the identification after all, they're not, you know, they're identified of not taking advantage of these programs, then they shouldn't have a contract. And all they're going to happen is you're going to be informed you're not getting a contract next year. Now, if you want to argue that and think you should stay because you're doing a good job, or maybe you're willing to come in and say, I'll take advantage of those programs, you have a process in place with this bill where you can go and be heard. You're not being turned out into the street without a voice. But what I would kind of ask is that in my county, where we have had one of these contests right now, and it went for months and months, and we really don't know the exact number, you know, 130 to 150,000 has been batted around. When you figure out, if you look at how we fund schools in the block grant, we went down and said, okay, we have all these positions. The numbers are driven by the ADMs to send that block grant out there. We're at 130 to 150,000. That could be two entry-level teachers. That could be a master's teacher with a bunch of years behind them, you know, crowding up into that. So what we've done is we've taken all that time and all that money, and we've sacrificed the possibility of a good teacher over here because we're pulling the system so far out and spending it over here. What this bill does is it pulls it in, it makes it more defined, and you address these situations. And I would hope that you would support the bill.
Reflecting on our next speaker, Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, before trying to sort out or the debate, I'd like to learn more about what the bill does to frame up the debate. And I'm not sure that I understand it. We have two statuses, and we have a probationary status, a non-probationary status. In the past, a non-probationary term or teacher is one that did not have a continuing contract. A continuing contract was a continuing contract teacher. So we have those two. I'm not understanding the distinction between those as in the new bill. What I think what the bill is saying is, correct me if I'm wrong, please, is that the notion is that all contracts are 1 year. Doesn't make a difference whether you're a continuing contract or a probationary contract. So the district has the right to choose to hire you the following year. So everybody's for 1 year at a time. And the only issue with respect to the suspension without pay and the suspension with pay is if you're terminated mid-year during your one-year contract. So that on January 1, if the district says, hey, look, we need you out of the classroom, we'll pay you till the end of the year, then you get this modified fast-track policy or practice, but the notion is you're going to get paid to the end of the year. If the district says, hey, you've done something terrible, egregious, we shouldn't have to pay you, they terminate you with pay or without pay, give you an administrative hearing. But in any event, it wouldn't make any difference because for all practical purposes, at the end of the year, they're free not to hire you anyway. So you got the whole issue with respect to
suspension with or without pay only addresses mid-year, mid-contract terminations. All teachers, regardless of your status, as I understand this, are only employed 1 year at a time with no right to expect to be rehired the next year unless the district chooses to hire them. And if that's the case, is there any difference between a probationary teacher and a non-probationary? Because that's where I'm getting confused. If they're all, if you've taken out the probationary definition altogether, everybody's in the same boat. You get one contract, and the only issue is what happens if you get terminated mid-year?
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, probationary status is the way the law is right now. First 3 years is probationary status. In trying to answer your question as it relates to and going back what the majority floor leader said, it's my understanding, and I'm going to read a little bit of this stuff, and this is my superintendent. For a long time, school districts have struggled with the concept of only being allowed to suspend teachers with pay pending a hearing. Now, I can't tell you that's exactly the way it is now, but I think it is. I think it is. When school districts receive news of teacher misconduct, such as felony criminal conduct, sexual abuse, drug abuse, etc., it is imperative that districts be able to immediately suspend teachers with pay, pending their ability to conduct an investigation and determine whether it is appropriate to proceed with termination, dismissal, or suspension without pay. Your legislation is a big help in this regard by deleting the requirement for a hearing in the definition of suspension with pay. Unfortunately, the use of the word suspension in some of the legislation being amended does not distinguish between a suspension with pay and a suspension without pay, and has the impact of undoing the very helpful change that you made to the definition of suspension with pay. Now, are you confused? In fact, it would seem to require notice and an opportunity for a hearing before you could even suspend a teacher with pay. I'll tell you, I think that no matter what goes on there out there right now, pending a hearing, I think they have to, those teachers have to be suspended with pay. In answer to the good majority floor leader's question, I think this is a little bit relevant to what you're talking about. The second issue, which I believe needs to be corrected in the draft legislation, is the intermingling of the concepts of dismissal and termination. They are distinctly different issues. As you know, termination is a decision by the Board of Trustees to not renew a contract of a teacher. Dismissal, on the other hand, is the process to terminate a teacher during the contract year. I hope that helps. I'm not sure I answered the questions, but I'm trying.
Senator Nicholas.
I appreciate it. Before we get off to debating the merits of the bill, I would like to make sure that we're all teed up on the same idea. My understanding from reading the bill is this. There is no distinction between a probationary teacher and a continuing contract teacher because all teachers are employed 1 year at a time. So, I mean, if all teachers have 1 year contract, then don't even worry about it. I mean, I understand it's in the bill, but you don't have to worry about that. Nobody gets a contract for more than 1 year. Point one. I think that's what the bill says. You don't have you have no opportunity to or right to be rehired for the next year unless the district feels that you're the teacher to go forward. That's point one. So at the end of the year, ignore all the old concepts that, I got to give you a hearing to if I'm going to deny you a contract. That's all gone. Continuing probationary doesn't make a difference. 1 year at a time. The second point is that this issue about hearings, whether you do it with pay or without pay, only applies in that instance where you want to terminate a teacher mid-year. And obviously, if you choose not to go to the termination process, you just simply wait till the contract expires, and then you don't have to do it. If you're going to take them out, I suppose, in February or March or April, you might as well pay them with, suspend them with, without pay, or with pay, because it's only going to be 2 months anyway. You're only talking about 1 month pay. But I want to make sure, do I understand that correctly? Nobody gets a contract for more than 1 year, and the termination provisions only apply for mid-contract, mid-year terminations.
Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that second part of what you said is exact, and maybe I misunderstood your comment. The way I read it, if you look at page 7, 21.7.110, it talks about suspension, termination, or dismissal, and they have to have all those reasons listed, of which most of it is already existing law. Then, of course, you have the without pay and with pay, and that's the provisions for the hearing. But if, in fact, you don't renew their contract for the next year, then they're able to go in front of the school board and be able to have their hearing there in front of the school board. The school board makes a decision, yay or nay, and then if they don't like what the school board does, then they have opportunities to proceed further. I think they can either go through the Administrative Procedures Act or into district court if they wanted to. I thought that's the way the bill was set up to do.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a small clarification on the statement made by the good senator from Laramie. Currently, you can have a contract not be renewed, and it just disappears. If the teacher says, I agree with you, thank you for keeping me through the end of the year, I don't want to come back either, it goes off and there's no hearing or anything that needs to be completed. If they disagree with you, then that's where you can go into the long-drawn process.
Senator Schiffer.
I appreciate that clarification. However, that's only available if you're terminating them mid-year. It doesn't matter. I agree. It doesn't matter whether you're probationary or non-probationary. At the end of the year, they can be out with no hearing. And I'm glad that my colleague from Park County read what his superintendent said, because I believe the superintendent said that also in his email. Doesn't make any difference. There is no distinction between a probationary teacher and a non-probationary teacher, with the exception of terminating them during the year. They're all the same. However, if you do, and this is the question I've got, if you do want to terminate a teacher mid-year, they're entitled to a hearing, and I'm on page 12. No, wait a minute, where am I? Okay, they're entitled to a hearing under, and I'm trying to get this figured out, and that's the hearing where the superintendent comes in with his written evidence and the teacher with theirs, and no oral testimony and no ability to cross-examination or anything like that. Then, as I remember, and that can be appealed to the district court, but I need some clarification here. As I remember, an appeal to the district court is only on the record from the initial hearing. Nothing else is allowed in. Nothing. So that what the district court is going to see is the written statement by the superintendent and the written statement by the teacher, doesn't matter whether they're probationary or non-probationary, and nothing else. No opportunity to investigate where the statements by the superintendent, hell, they could be a bunch of damn lies. And quite often probably are. That's not allowed. That is absolutely, you cannot do it. That hearing would be meaningless, I believe, and certainly not in the terms that we think of a hearing as being able to say, what's the truth? How good really is this teacher? Nope. Superintendent could say, this is a crummy teacher. Boom, that's done. Second part of that, when it goes to district court, as I understand this, there's no opportunity to discuss, or you don't take a lawyer, you don't take anything. It's strictly on the record with the judge. And I want some clarification there. I believe that's what it is, and that would apply to all teachers, probationary or non-probationary, which doesn't mean anything, except I think probationary, you get a big B on your T-shirt or something, I don't know. But that's about it. Am I correct on that? No. I think that's what your superintendent told us, too.
Under our office.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This intervention is actually just to clarify a couple of things, because there is a little bit of confusion, I think, still. Mr. Chairman, there still is a slight difference between probationary and non-probationary based on the language of the bill as it's currently drafted. That language difference is on page 7, line 10, where if you are a non-probationary, you will have termination grounds based on what you see there and any other good or just cause, which has some legal standing in that it has to be related to education. Now, when you look on page 11 at the hearing that's involved for a termination, which means an end-of-the-year contract termination or non-renewal, when you're looking on lines 9 and 10, 8, 9, and 10, we'll go with that, the board shall determine if termination is based upon reasons provided in the notice of termination submitted pursuant to statute 217105, which means that for a termination situation for a non-probationary teacher, it would have to include good or just cause. For a probationary teacher, it would not have to have good or just cause. It would only have to be for any reason not specifically prohibited by law. That's not a big difference, but there is a difference, and I think there was a little bit of a lack of clarity on that. The other point that I've been hearing, which is a little bit incorrect, but actually Senator Schiffer's indicating to some degree, my apologies, Senator from KC, there is no oral testimony given in the termination case. I keep hearing some of my fellow colleagues talk about the fact that they'll get a chance to talk in front of the board and have their say. In fact, they submit some paperwork. The superintendent of the district submits some paperwork. The board looks at the paperwork, and then they either terminate or don't terminate based on that decision point. So when you're saying hearing, please don't think of somebody standing in front and arguing on their behalf, because as you see on page 11, lines 7 and 8, it specifically says oral testimony shall not be taken. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for those clarification opportunities.
Thank you. Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few more questions on the bill that I'm still not clear on, you know, and I'm hearing that page 2, lines 9 through 13 there, where it talks about the administration have a written evaluation of these non-probationary teachers every year, that's going to be creating an administrative nightmare, that there isn't a time in the year for these administrators to do all of the things they need to do, plus, a complete write-up on all of these teachers. The concerns I have, is this going to create, as I said, administrative nightmare? Is it going to create that we're going to need a lot more administrators? Is this going to raise the cost of education and the fact that we're going to need more people there? And then also, Mr. Chairman, if you look on page 7 of the bill, and you look at the existing language that's being struck, it says the board may suspend or dismiss any teacher or terminate any continued contract teacher. Existing language is being struck. Today, they can get rid of teachers for incompetency. If you have a continued contract, that doesn't matter. As far as if administration is doing their job, now you're saying if that administration isn't doing their job and they're not evaluating these teachers, but then the bill forces them to be evaluated, they don't have the time to do it. If they're saying they don't have the time to do it today, they're not going to have the time to do it. You're going to be creating more of an administrative nightmare. I submit that there is already in statute
the ability for the school districts to get rid of the teachers that they don't, that aren't performing correctly. And then the other concern I had is, and maybe somebody could clear this up, but I heard that, you know, one of the concerns or issues of, is of laying off teachers. And that that somehow getting rid of continued contracts, you're going to be able to keep teachers that are performing better or, you know, that are junior. And my understanding is that if layoffs are consistent or done by seniority, that continued contract really has nothing to do with whether or not they're getting laid off. If you don't have a continued contract system, but it's still based on years of service, I don't understand completely how that's going to help. And then there is, you know, I'm sure that there's anecdotal stories out there everywhere, you know, of administrators. We have a situation in Sweetwater County at one of the junior highs that an administrator got crossways with, well, one of the building level principals got crossways with administration simply because of a personnel issue, and the principal didn't want to bow down to the administrator on a specific personnel issue. And that teacher was let go for no other reason. Now, to really really to emphasize this point of what happened next, every student in that building went out and walked out of that building and was out in the, on the ball field, as with parents, as with many of the teachers. That principal that was just let go by the administrator just because she didn't cower down had to go out there and say, look, guys, get back to school. Your education is more important. These are the kind of things that are going to happen. It's just at somebody's whim. And, you know, with just cause, we have reasons in here for just cause today. With continued contracts, it's not going to make a difference that I can see on the layoffs. And there's already provisions in the existing laws.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee hold beg leave to rise and sit again.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Is anybody opposed? Okay, you've got these back. I've got a mess out of this.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate stand adjourned or recess until 2 p.m.
Are there any announcements? Senator Hines?
That close to getting out of you.
The committee number three, revenue, will meet in approximately 15 minutes in room S16 to take out House Bill 143, engrossed manufacturing tax exemptions, House Bill 138, public funds, time deposit, open account interest rate, and House Joint Resolution 2 and Gross Resolution, U.S. Constitution, requiring a balanced budget.
Other announcements? Seeing none, I guess. You heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The Senate will still stand recess until 2 p.m.
I wonder.